I am Planta on the line. This is thecommentary.ca. Tony Parsons is a household name, and his is one of the most recognizable faces in British Columbia. For over 35 years now, he has anchored the popular Supper Hour News Hour broadcast on Global BC. The late Denny Boyd once described him in a column as polite, correct, and almost David Nivenly diffident. He joins me to discuss his 50-plus year career, which he writes about in his new book, A Life in the News. It's a great view on to the newscasts that we've watched for years, the people who've appeared there. We learn of his upbringing in England, a radio career in Stratford, Ontario, to his big break at CFTO in Toronto, to coming to Vancouver for CTV in the 1970s. It's a great read, lively and often funny. It's also thoughtful, especially when the author looks ahead to the future of news and media in this country. Next year, Tony Parsons leaves the NewsHour, retiring as anchor of the most watched regional newscast in Canada. This book is a wonderful opportunity to look back. It's published by Harbour. I'm very pleased to welcome to the Plant Online program Tony Parsons. Good morning, Mr. Parsons.
Good morning. Thank you.
Are you stopped everywhere you go, like people know who you are, I guess?
A lot of times I am, and you know what? It's a very pleasant thing. I mean, people aren't pushy or argumentative about anything I've said or anything they thought I've missaid. And so, you know, it's hi the other day. I was in Victoria promoting the book, as a matter of fact, and somebody came up to me and said, I hope you never quit. You're our Walter Cronkite. I mean, that's, you know, that's so flattering. But it's the kind of thing I get often when I travel around the province.
And people ask about the dog, obviously.
They always ask about the dog. Where's the dog? Two dogs have been in my life and in the book. One of them was Charlie, who I rescued from the SPCA, and he became a fixture in the newsroom, slept at my feet during the newscast at 6 o'clock and became a popular dog with the audience. And then after he passed, then Jack came along, and Jack belonged to Tammy, my wife, and it was quite strange, actually. The first time I took him in the newsroom, it was almost as if he was hearing a voice from Charlie, the previous dog, saying, this is what you do when you get to the newsroom. You follow Tony to the desk and you lay at his feet adoringly. Sleep if you like, but wake up at 7, then go home.
And Jack does that still?
Jack does it still, yeah.
So when we watched you on the news the other night, he was at your feet?
The other night, probably not, because he's enjoying a little vacation in Big White with Tammy's dad and stepmom, so we often have to ship him off if we're going traveling a lot. So
now, in all the years that you had the dog underneath the desk, did it ever do anything while you were reading the news, say, tug at your pant leg or anything like that?
No. Jack sometimes scratches at my leg if he wants a treat, but I've sort of weaned him off that idea. And Charlie used to have barked once, not during the newscast, but oddly enough, in a break.
Yeah.
So nobody heard him. Somebody came into the studio that he didn't recognize, and he started to bark, and I calmed him down, and he was fine after that.
Now, you do the newscast twice a week, do you?
Twice a week now, Tuesday, Wednesdays. It's called semi-retirement, I think, and it makes for an enjoyable five-day weekend most times.
It's funny because people still think you do it 5 days a week, right?
Well, I guess they do. I don't. People don't come up to me and say, well, where are you? You know, the other nights of the week, they say, oh, we see you all, you know, every night on the news hour. You're quite right. I don't know where they get that idea, but no, I just do Tuesday and Wednesday.
Is Chris Galis your successor at the broadcast?
He's the chosen man, yeah. Chris is a good young guy. He's a Canadian. His family lives in Soyuz, I believe, and he worked in Calgary for one of our global stations. And then he went stateside and worked down there, ending up in New York for one of the Fox stations doing morning news and a morning show of some kind. And when he heard that we were casting around for my successor, he, like a lot of others, applied for the job, and he was the guy we picked.
Now, the transition sort of waiting for you to leave, was that your idea, or whose idea was that? Was it the station?
It was an idea I agreed to. They said, you know, sooner or later, we're going to have to replace you because you want to retire or for whatever circumstances. So I said, yeah, you really should get somebody on board. We can train or get used to our idea of doing newscasts. And so they went went out and they found Chris. And, yeah, I think he's going to do fine.
And ratings-wise, this transition has been pretty good. You're still number one?
We're still number one. Ratings have held up. And, in fact, on some nights, they're much larger than they used to be for one reason or another. And we have a new system of counting people, and that's come out in our favor. So we get bigger numbers all the time.
Did you have fun writing this book?
You know, I did. People think it's a catharsis of some kind. It really isn't. I took it on as a project as much as anything. And when I was first approached to write the book, I said to the literary agent, Brian Wood, you know, Brian, I don't know that I have a book in me. I don't know that I can remember people or events, names, times, situations, events. And he coaxed me into doing it. He said, you know, just give it a try. Just start. And I said, well, I'll do it on one proviso, but I write it myself, and you can get an editor to work on it later. But I just want to write it myself. So I started, and I started at the beginning, you know, when I was a kid in England. And as I wrote, things began to fall in place, and I kept remembering incidents and so on and so forth. And I even remembered, which is most astonishing to me, when we came to Canada in 1948, we flew in to Toronto eventually, and then we made our way up to a little place called Flesherton by bus, I believe, or by car, I'm not sure. But we were picked up to finish the journey to a place called Feversham, not far away, and we were picked up by a chap named Laurie Sewell. Now, I haven't thought of that name since 1948, but it popped into my head. So that began to be the process, and it made it a lot easier for me to put things down on paper when I realized maybe I haven't forgotten all the things that have happened to me.
You talk about your mom in the book, and you describe her as saint-like. She got to see a lot of your success, didn't she?
She did, yeah. She was very proud of my accomplishments. My father, not so much. But Mom always thought that I had done well, and I had picked my job and my vocation properly, and she was proud. She used to write to me and tell me that she sees me on satellite. You know, I was in Toronto. She was living in Sarnia, Ontario, which is, you know, a couple of hundred miles apart, but she used to watch the show, and she would call and say, hey, that was a nice tie you wore last night, yeah, but you know what, you need a haircut, things like that, you know, like moms do.
Yeah. You mentioned your dad there earlier. You said that he didn't, not so much. Did you mean that he hadn't seen your success, or he wasn't proud of your success?
Well, I know he wasn't outwardly proud. My father was a carpenter and a man of many talents. As a matter of fact, he was good with his hands, and that's how he made his living over the years. And he thought, unless you did something physical, as he did, then you weren't really working. It wasn't a real job. And so he never said to me, you know, you really do a good job as a newscaster. You chose well. He sort of grudgingly admitted toward the end of his life that, yeah, he was proud, but he didn't say anything to me. He said it to his friends, and I got it back from them. And he just thought that, I don't think he really understood what I did and actually made a living from it, you know.
People seem to write memoirs as you said, as an outlet for thinking about themselves and a catharsis. You said you didn't write it in that vein, but you do talk about your father's drinking, and you mentioned that you had a bit of a problem as well. How bad was it for you?
It got to be out of control. I was using a drink for reasons I don't really understand. I had a great job. I had good money coming in, and I also mentioned in the book that I suffered from depression, and I think that got me started. And I went hard at it for a number of years until I finally, either friends or relatives said, you know, you drink an awful lot, don't you? And I, of course, you deny it, but after a while I sat down and thought about it, and yeah, I did drink a lot. I drank hard liquor, and I drank my share, and it never interrupted what I did for a living, but it certainly didn't endear me to a lot of people around me.
Yeah, and now you have it under control?
It's under control. I still drink wine. I like my wine, but that's the only thing I drink now. I mean, not that that's, you know, not liquor in, you know, in everybody else's estimation, but I don't drink. I can control it. I do.
Yeah. And you also talk about your marriages. You've had more than one, let's put it that way.
That's kind of you.
Yeah. You're married to Tammy now. You dedicate the book to her.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think you know now that you didn't know before?
I don't know what I know now. I just know that I'm finally with the right person. And, you know, in my business, and this sounds immodest, I think, you sometimes wonder why a person is with you. Is it for the notoriety? Is it for the money? Or is it because they really do love you and want to be with you? So I think there was always a certain doubt in my mind with other people. And that caused a lot of sorrow in my life. I would call myself a cad if I hadn't written that in the book. Then I would now call myself a cad, because I had a way of treating people badly if I had, as my mother would say, gone off them for whatever reason.
You do write that in the book. You call yourself that.
Oh, do I? Okay.
Yeah, you do, yeah. Did you regret not having children?
No. No, I really do admire people, parents, who raise children in this day and age with everything that's around us, you know, the temptations of drugs and other things, and the way the world has gone in terms of war right now, and so on and so forth. There's so many things to concern yourself with. Raising kids is, to me, a real challenge, and I'm a little bit too self-centered to have children.
Reading the book, you talk about this lunch that you had with Cameron Bell and Keith Bradbury, just before Keith Bradbury died, about wanting to write a book about the NewsHour and what made that successful. And I was thinking to myself that that had been a great book to read.
That's why we got together. We all agreed that if we all put our ideas together and put them on paper, my thought was that why don't we each do a different version of a book, and then combine the ideas and winnow out the stuff that didn't matter, and write a book. I would have thought because those guys started it, I came along after it was a success. I helped it along the way, but you know, Cameron and Keith put flesh on the bones, and they had great ideas. They were way ahead of their time, and I was fortunate to have an association with them. And you're right. I think it would have been a great book.
And I mean, people mention talk about this that it is the most successful regional newscast in the continent, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, if you had to break it down, if there was a formula as to what makes it good, or what makes it the envy of nearly everyone in your business, what do you think it is?
I think it's a lot to do with the people we have. We have reporters with longevity. They are comfortable with the audience, and the audience is comfortable with them. They put in years of foot slogging, hard work, and they've survived things that other people haven't. And I mean economic turmoil, recessionary things, and they've stuck to it. But we had a method of doing the news that we thought was unique in terms of everyday coverage. For instance, when I worked in Toronto, we used to write the story, and then the pictures would be cut to what we wrote. When I got to Vancouver, they were cutting the pictures and writing after the pictures were cut. So I think that made a vast difference, because it is a visual medium. So you got better, more and better pictures on the air. I think that was one of the things. But we weren't afraid in our time to, you know, go after people, hold their feet to the fire, and we were, I think we were pretty tough on some people, which I thought stood us in good stead.
And if you watch some of the other newscasts, I don't know, do you do that yourself?
I don't often. I don't get a chance because I'm on the air about the same time they are. I'm watching the new CBC. I see what they're doing.
Yeah.
And I wonder why they're doing it, because I don't know what they're trying to do. What I'm trying to say.
Yeah.
It's a little over the top for me. The standing up thing, they moving around the studio, the distraction that causes for me, at least. But I do like having the morning news, CBC morning news. I think I think they do a good job there. But the visual aspect of it doesn't really please me in a way.
And and I guess it, well, what I meant to say was, if you watch all the newscasts in this town, you see people that have that have come out of BCTV, and you see that they're copying a lot of the things that you people did over there,
which in a way is flattering. And I think the only difference in many cases is the, of course, the people and the sets are different. I think some of the content on our competitors' newscasts is very good, and there are days when I have watched our competitors and I've said to myself, why didn't we have that story, or why didn't we do it that way? So, you know, they're not doing it wrong. We just got here first.
And in terms of the economy and the marketplace, all of your newsrooms are obviously facing the pinch. Do you think you'll weather this at Global there?
I think we'll weather it locally. I'm not sure what's going to happen to Global at large. They have a tremendous amount of debt, and now, of course, they filed for bankruptcy protection. I don't know, frankly, how they're going to get out of it. But you've seen some things happen. Czech television, for instance, in Victoria has been sold to the employees and other investors. The same thing happened in Hamilton at CHCH. A new company bought that, and so it goes. As they divest, it changes the landscape. And I only hope that community television over the long haul survives. How they do the network thing, I really don't know.
Did you ever have the opportunity to go to the States for your career?
I was asked several times. I was asked by CNN and a couple of stations, one in San Francisco, one in Chicago. And I seriously thought about it, but then when I sat down and assessed what I had already, a great lifestyle, a great place to live, good people to work for, and a pretty tidy salary, I thought, you know, I really don't want to go. One of the reasons was you're only as good as your last show when you're in the States. If there's a problem with ratings, they usually look at the personnel first and the content second. Whereas here, we do it the other way around. And I decided, why move if I'm happy here and take a risk at being unhappy somewhere else?
How serious were you considering going over to the other channel, the CTV?
I was serious at first, but I think I said I was a little mischievous about that because I wanted to see, I thought I might see what they were going to be throwing at us when
right.
they became the guys down the street. And I went and I talked to them, and they told me they weren't afraid of the money I was making, et cetera, et cetera. They knew this, that, and the other thing about me. And I was working under contract, for one thing. So I went back to the station after talking to them, and I thought to myself, you know, I really can't do this. Out of loyalty to the people that have stood behind me for a number of years, I just think it would be disloyal to suddenly pick up sticks and go. So I decided I would stay. And then shortly after, of course, they hired Pamela Martin and Bill Good away from us. And they've done well. They haven't touched us in terms of ratings, but, you know, they have a pretty good product.
Now, people still think of you and Pamela on television. You were just great on TV together. Were you friends off the air?
Yeah, we were. We were great friends. I have a lot of time for Pamela. I think she's done really well in this market, and she fronts a pretty good newscast. And yeah, we're friends. And she and I saw eye to eye on most things, and we were comfortable with each other on air. And to tell you the truth, I miss her.
She doesn't come off too well in the book in terms of how she left the station.
Well, it was an odd thing because things were changing at the station. The newscast that Bill Good was doing called Canada Tonight, which was a local version of a thing I did at 3:30 most days, it was coming off the air because of the advent of the national news with Global. So we said to Bill, look, we want you to co-anchor with Pamela. And because we want to keep you around. And he didn't think that was such a bad idea, but Pamela was confronted with it and didn't think much of the idea, thought she was being punished in a sense and didn't know the reason why. And so she got very upset and went and asked, you know, what's going on? Why are you doing this? Why, you know, I've always done this solo, this 5 o'clock show. Now you're throwing a co-anchor at me. And, you know, we said, you know, calm down. It's, you know, it's not a big deal. It could work out for both of you. And shortly after that, she left and went to CTV down the street. And not long after that, Bill followed, and as her co-anchor, and we couldn't reconcile what we knew about the way she felt about working with Bill, and the way it worked out for the two of them working at our competitors.
And you surmise in the book that they don't get along or they're uncomfortable with one another on the air?
I don't detect, frankly, any great chemistry. I think there's still the residue of that upset that Pamela had. I just don't feel that they, I'm sure they like each other. I just don't think they like working together.
Norm Groman, growing up, I used to watch him do the weather. Of course, watch Wayne now. He was a great part of the show. What I enjoyed reading in the book was that he was sort of thin-skinned when it came to the humor on the broadcast.
Well, I always got the impression that Norm had staked out his territory as the sort of comic relief on the show. He wasn't, first of all, a meteorologist, and was what we know as a weather person, as Wayne is. But I always thought that, you know, the thing, the shtick he did on the show was his way of saying, you know, I'm the funny guy out of this group, and don't dare encroach on my territory. So I was always a bit chary about being funny if I ever could. And I always thought that if I cracked a joke or, you know, made a remark of any kind that was a bit of levity in the show, that he sort of resented it. I think, you know, and I always had that feeling, and he may not have felt that way, but it's the way I felt.
Do most people in your business who read the news, do they write their own copy?
Not so much anymore. I did a lot when I first arrived at the station. I used to enjoy writing the show, parts of the show at least, and not so much anymore. We have producers on every show. We have writers on every show. The producers write. Deb writes a lot of her copy for her show at 5 o'clock, and some of the noon people, and so on. But I don't anymore. I became a part of the administration, and that sort of got me away from writing. I was made vice president of news in charge of the newsroom some time ago. So I took up administrative duties and left the writing to other people.
So what's a typical day like? Is it a lot of office work for you?
Not anymore. In this state of retirement, I don't go to the office until about 3-4 o'clock in the afternoon. So it's a very short day, so you don't get much accomplished in that sense. I still work away from home. I can go on my home computer and find out what the lineup is and who's doing what and so on and so forth. I don't see copy until I actually get to the station. And I'm one of those people who don't like to read the copy before I take it to wear, because I want to have the same reaction as the audience. I want to know that they're hearing it as I do for the first time. And I feel better that way. I think my interpretation is better.
Yeah. You mentioned this lady that came up to you in Victoria and said that you were our Walter Cronkite. Did you watch him growing up? Was he someone that you admired?
I think so, yeah. I think all of us, my generation, watched him and some of the other guys who were prominent then. You know, the Brokaws, the after Cronkite, Dan Rather, Huntley, Brinkley. They were all part of my education in terms of electronic journalism. And I admired Cronkite. I thought he was the leader, and he was, you know, most Americans voted him the most trusted man in America, and I thought that was very, very significant.
And I think they did a poll about you, and you were voted the most trusted man in British Columbia, I think, at one point, right?
I was at one time. I don't know how I merited that, but it's it's a funny thing when you do what I do.
Yeah.
I had a friend on Bowen Island, where I lived for a while, and he was an older guy, and his name, they called him Minnow. He was sort of a village fixture over there, and he came up to me one day when I was in the ferry lineup, and he said to me, "You know, you are the wisest man I've ever seen on television." Now, I don't know how he got that idea, because, you know, a lot of it is reading, and a lot of it is knowing something, but I certainly wasn't the wisest man on television, but that was his take on what I did. So people have that impression that because you do what you do, it's much more than it really is.
Now, the Olympics are coming up. Are you at Global there? Are people going to be doing stuff on it? I know you're not the network, but...
There are certain limitations on what we can do,
yeah.
So we won't have a full-blown part of it, but we'll be doing sidebar stuff, and we'll be getting involved in a lot of it on a periphery sense. And I'll be doing the news those 2 weeks, and Chris and the other reporters will be handling the actual Olympic events.
And then is that when you leave, soon after that?
I will be leaving almost the day after
the
Olympics end. And I do that with a lot of sorrow because I thoroughly enjoyed my 35-plus years with BCTV and Global. And I'm not really ready to retire, even though I'm 70 years old. I still think I have a lot to offer, and I'll cast around and see if there are things I can do. As a mentor, perhaps, as a consultant, as whatever. I just don't really want to walk away from it altogether.
Yeah. I mean, speaking for myself, I'm sure there are a lot of people that will miss you. Finally, your colleague Mike McArdle has a book out as well from the same publisher. Is there a competition between the two of you as to who will sell more?
That man is a machine.
Yeah.
He turns out books faster than I can read them, but he's a great guy, and I've always enjoyed his stuff. We're not in a competition, although I've been told that this coming week, this Saturday, I'll be number 4 on the bestseller list in D.C., so that's gratifying, and Mike's been number 1 for a long time, off and on, with his production of books. And so we sort of check at each other. I said to him once, as I was in the writing process, look, I need your advice, you know, on how to handle this, and he said, well, I've got 5 minutes. Give me your questions, and I'll answer them if I can. There was no jealousy about book writing. My books are totally different than his. My book is totally different than his.
Yeah.
But he thought it was kind of funny, me writing a book, I think.
Tony, it's been such a pleasure to talk to you, as I said, you know, watching you for years. Continued good luck with the book and in your retirement as well.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
You're very welcome. The book is called The Life in the News. Do pick it up. It's a great read. From Harbor Publishing, and do watch the News Hour on Global BC. Its author, Tony Parsons, on the line. In Vancouver, I'm Joseph Planum.